It is time the free world got together to decisively confront the U.S. We are fully confident that the day will soon come when the United States of America disintegrates into several republics and ceases to be great Satan that it is.
Ukraine on Fire, Part 1.
Here in Kiev in recent days, the Maidan, Independence Square, has turned into a full-scale war zone.
More clashes in Ukraine's capital, Kiev.
There is absolutely no doubt that snipers are working here. I've counted 10 bodies.
Now on the brink of a civil war, at least 70 dead so far, and the death toll rising.
What we saw here today was a revolution.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries, up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
The focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky, the gold its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East in World War I and World War II. And every time, the Ukrainian people ended up paying the highest price for these grand games of power. History doesn't repeat, but it surely rhymes, said Mark Twain. If one looks closely at the history of Ukraine, one will notice many rhymes. Being surrounded by stronger powers, Ukraine has needed a lot of cunning to survive, and the art they truly mastered with time is the art of changing sides. In the middle of the 17th century, Ukrainian leader Bogdan Khmelnytsky broke a truce agreement made with Poland, siding with more powerful Russia. Just over 50 years later, as the Russian-Swedish War was raging, another Ukrainian leader, Ivan Mazepa, broke the union with Russia when he switched sides, joining forces with the Swedish invaders. Many times, Ukrainian history was written by third parties. Seeking to keep the gains of a revolution at any cost, Russia agreed to the humiliating conditions of the Brest-Litovsk Treaty of 1918, which turned Ukraine into a German protectorate. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939, one of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. No sooner had the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact been signed than Poland was split. And in September of 1939, Eastern Poland awoke to be Western Ukraine and a part of the family of Soviet republics and the USSR. But even this bold dividing of lands and nations only delayed the inevitable. Germany broke its promise to the USSR. On June 22, 1941, Germany invaded the USSR, launching Barbarossa, the largest military operation in world history. Barbarossa was aiming for St. Petersburg, Moscow, and Kiev, Ukraine, three destinations of major significance. Ukraine, with its rich lands and resources, was an important industrial and economic source for the USSR. To cut it off from the Soviet Union would strike a big blow indeed. For most of the Soviet Union, the Second World War was about fighting the invaders of their land. But it wasn't quite so simple for Ukraine. The truth is, Ukraine has never been a united country. When World War II broke out, a large part of Western Ukraine's population welcomed the German soldiers as liberators from the recently forced upon them Soviet rule and openly collaborated with the Germans. The real scale of collaboration was not announced for many years after the war, but we now know that whole divisions and battalions were formed by Ukrainian collaborators, such as SS Galician, Noctigal, and Roland battalions. Just in the beginning of the war, more than 80,000 people from Galicina region voluntarily enrolled into Division SS Galician in a month and a half, notorious for their extreme cruelty towards the Polish, Jewish, and Russian people on the territory of Ukraine. Members of these military groups came mostly from the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the OUN, founded in 1929. This organization had an ultimate goal of creating an ethnically pure, independent Ukraine, and considered terror an acceptable tool for achieving their ends. Their official flag was black and red, land and blood. It will remain in Ukraine's history long after the OUN will cease to exist. In early 1940, the most radical nationalistic part of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists got its own leader, Stepan Bandera. Severely anti-Semitic and anti-communist, he proclaimed an independent Ukraine in 1941. His German allies frowned upon such an act of self-will, and it landed him in prison for nearly all the Second World War. Not participating in the events physically, Bandera still managed to successfully spread his ideology. Many independent historians estimate that the OUN militia exterminated from 150 to 200,000 Jews on Ukrainian territory occupied by the Germans by the end of 1941. The most notorious and outrageous massacre took place September 29th and 30th, 1941, in Babi Yar, Kiev. All kikes of the city of Kiev and its vicinity must appear on Monday, September 29th, by 8 o'clock in the morning. Bring documents, money, and valuables, and also warm clothing, linen, etc. Any kikes who do not follow this order and are found elsewhere will be shot. 33,771 Jews were killed in this two-day operation of the Nazis and Ukrainian militia. Another outrageous massacre was carried out by the Ukrainian Insurgent Army and the Bandera faction of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists in German-occupied Polish Volhynia and Eastern Galicia between 1943 and 1944. This genocide of Poles was led by Mykola Lebed. 35,000 to 60,000 people in Volhynia and 25 to 40,000 in Eastern Galicia fell victim to this massive ethnic cleansing operation. Sensing the inevitable loss of the German troops, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists gave up on their former ally and began fighting equally against the Germans and the Soviet forces. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. Bandera's bands continued to wage their guerrilla war against the Soviet regime, carrying out bloody raids on Ukrainian villages and towns, and leaving behind chaos and casualties. This war went on until the middle of the 1950s, when the last collaborators were either detained or fled the country. On May 7, 1945, Germany unconditionally surrendered to the Allies. Ukraine remained a part of the Soviet Union. The peace after the Second World War was short-lived. The United States and the Soviet Union, nations who allied together along with England to defeat the Nazis, tragically became foes as the Cold War began. The era of political and military tension between the U.S. and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian nationalist organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or their leader, Stepan Bandera himself. According to an OSS report of September 1945, Bandera had earned a fierce reputation for conducting a reign of terror during World War II. After the Second World War, Bandera and other Ukrainian Nazi leaders fled to Europe, where the CIA helped them hide. The CIA later informed the Immigration and Naturalization Service that it had concealed Stepan Bandera and other Ukrainians from the Soviets. The operations involving Ukrainians continued for many years. The Nuremberg trials of 1945 and 1946 brought the political, economic, and military leaders of fascist Germany to justice and revealed to the world the monstrous face of Nazism and the crimes they committed. But the Ukrainian Nazis were spared the same fate, and some were even granted indulgences by the CIA. By 1954, the agency excused the illegal activities of the OUN security branch in the name of Cold War necessity. In 1949, Mykola Lebed, the man responsible for the massacres in Volhynia, was moved to the United States, where he died in 1989 without ever being investigated or pursued as a war criminal. The CIA moved to protect Ukrainian nationalist leader Mykola Lebed from criminal investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1952. Perhaps Bandera lost his use to the U.S., or maybe KGB agents outsmarted the CIA, but in 1959, Stepan Bandera, the leader of the Ukrainian nationalists, was killed in Munich, where he was hiding under the name of Stefan Popel. It would be fair to say that Bandera became a major symbol of Ukrainian nationalism by sheer chance, for he was neither its only leader nor its most powerful one. Dmytro Dontsov was the father of the far-right totalitarian doctrine in Ukraine. Andriy Melnyk was the leader of another faction of the OUN. Roman Shuhevich was a general of the Ukrainian insurgent army, and others contributed greatly to the movement. Bandera's dangerous ideology, suppressed by the communist authorities, but supported by external forces, never really died. The seeds of Ukrainian nationalism were passed from generation to generation. Unfortunately, it was just a matter of time before they would once again blossom. In 1954, Ukraine's territory was expanded even more when Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the USSR, and a Ukrainian himself, generously gave the Crimean region to Ukraine. Historians would argue about the legitimacy of this transfer for many years to come, and 60 years after Khrushchev's gift, dramatic new events would take place in Crimea.
The eyes of the world are on Ukraine as the crisis in Crimea continues.
Dozens of heavily armed men seized government buildings in Crimea.
Should Ukraine just shrug its shoulders and say, okay, Crimea, it's lost?
And the old arguments would heat up once again. The Cold War would heat up and cool down by turns, while both rivals were obsessively building up military capacity. The turning point took place when the new era, Perestroika, came to the USSR with its new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, in the middle of the 1980s. Perestroika meant restructuring towards liberalization and democratization. It certainly had a positive impact on the international situation.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore.
But inside the USSR, the weakening of Kremlin control had different consequences. In Ukraine, a nationalistic political organization, Narodny Rukh, or People's Movement, emerged in 1989 due to this new openness. They advocated for independence of Ukraine from the USSR and became an incubator for leaders of Ukrainian neo-Nazism. In 1991, one of them, Oleg Tyagnibok, founded Svoboda, an openly radical nationalist party preaching the good old principles of Bandera. Purge Ukraine from the Jews and Russians, Ukraine for Ukrainians, and so on. His statements got him fifth place in the Simon Wiesenthal Center Top 10 Anti-Semitic World Leader Rankings of 2012, but also, sadly, attracted numerous followers. Dmitry Yarosh founded another extreme right organization, TRIZU, or Trident, in 1994. In April 2013, Yarosh became an assistant to a member of parliament from the opposition party UDAR. Later that same year, he would become the leader of the most radical Ukrainian Nazi group, the Right Sector. Andriy Paruby would soon appear leading a whole army of ultra-nationalist warriors. And the torch marches would once again light up the streets of Ukrainian cities. The world drastically changed in August 1991, when the USSR de facto ceased to exist, and the global political map welcomed many newcomers, Ukraine one of them. In modern history, it was the first time Ukraine was truly independent and all on its own.
The red flag came down over the Kremlin tonight as President Gorbachev resigned and brought to an end 7 decades of communist rule in the Soviet Union.
The years after the disintegration of the USSR became known as the Crazy 90s in all the post-Soviet territories.
He's leaving behind 15 independent states which share only a disastrous economy and an uncertain future.
After having been under a government-controlled economy, the free market dramatically changed the rules of the game. New businesses emerged instantly, and the first oligarchs were born overnight. The former country with no class division suddenly became stratified. The chosen few became rich, while the rest had to fight to survive. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before. The color revolutions.
Demonstrators clash with police, hundreds of thousands protesting the results of the election and calling for a new vote.
Ukraine has had 2 color revolutions in its 24 years of independence. In 2004, crowds of people descended upon Kiev, marking the start of the Orange Revolution. At that time, Ukraine became once again a battlefield of 2 forces, the Russian and Western governments. The culmination of this conflict took place during the presidential elections in November of 2004. The two major candidates, Western-backed Viktor Yushchenko and Russian-leaning Viktor Yanukovych, almost equally shared the votes of Ukrainians. By the way, calling Viktor Yushchenko Western-backed is not an exaggeration. His wife, Katerina Yushchenko, is a former U.S. State Department official and worked in the White House during the Reagan administration. The division was along geographic lines. Traditionally, Russian Eastern Ukraine voted for Yanukovych, while Western Ukraine chose Yushchenko. By the announced result, Viktor Yushchenko lost to Viktor Yanukovych, but thousands of people didn't agree with it, and they came to the central square of Kiev on the 22nd of November. The situation received wide news coverage.
The country's election commission ignored reports of fraud, declaring Kremlin-backed Viktor Yanukovych the winner.
International politicians, such as former General Secretary of NATO, Javier Solana, became frequent guests in Kiev, initiating negotiations between parties.
And I hope very much that the goodwill of everybody will be able to overcome this difficulty.
The results of the negotiations, however, were often reached only on paper. Thus, Yushchenko never told the supporters to stop blocking government buildings in central Kiev. Therefore, these non-violent and very orange protests lasted for a month, during which time the previous election results were annulled, marred by massive corruption, and new elections were announced. An important nuance, just 3 months before, Viktor Yushchenko became a victim to a mysterious and still unsolved poisoning. But it didn't prevent him from winning in the new election. Though, as we shall soon see, there was much more than just the people's will that led to this victory. This peaceful revolution and its leader were warmly welcomed by the international community. But the euphoria didn't last long. Yushchenko's government completely failed with reforms and lost its chance to establish democracy, instead descending into infighting. Viktor Yushchenko was not re-elected for a second term, but at the end of his presidency, he had the time to make one last gift to his supporters from Western Ukraine. The hero status of Stepan Bandera was short-lived. In 2010, Viktor Yanukovych was elected president. This time, the international community had no doubts about the legitimacy of the elections. In January 2011, Viktor Yanukovych repealed the hero title of Bandera. Almost 4 years into his presidency, though, another revolution shook Ukraine. Unfortunately, this one was anything but peaceful.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Even brief disruptions in access to food can have lasting consequences, wrote the authors of a new analysis of worsening hunger among U.S. families. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stansil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Millions More Kids Are Going Hungry in the U.S. Here's the story. A new analysis confirms that the number of U.S. households with kids that report not having enough food to eat has surged in the months since corporate Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia joined Senate Republicans in refusing to extend the expanded child tax credit benefit beyond mid-December. Data from the Household Pulse Survey, HPS, a nationally representative internet survey conducted by U.S. Census Bureau, shows that from April 27th to May 9th, 15% of households with children reported food insufficiency, defined as sometimes or often not having enough food to eat in the past week. In early August, the percentage of families with kids that reported struggling with hunger was roughly 9.5%. Food has become more expensive in recent months as a handful of corporate grocery giants and meat, egg, dairy conglomerates have raised prices while cutting frontline worker pay and raking in record profits amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. But Manchin and the GOP's decision to allow the enhanced CTC benefit to expire at the end of last year is making it even harder for millions of families in the United States to make ends meet. Right-wing lawmakers led the enlarged CTC lapse despite ample evidence that the popular measure improved the lives of children nationwide. In January, the first month since July 2021, that eligible families didn't receive a monthly payment of up to $300 per child, 3.7 million kids were thrown into poverty. In a guest blog post published recently by the Economic Policy Institute, Julia Reifman, assistant professor at Boston University School of Public Health, and Allison Bovell-Ammon, director of policy strategy for Children's Health Watch at Boston Medical Center, wrote, "In prior work using HPS data, we found that the advanced CTC was associated with a 26% decrease in food insufficiency in U.S. households with children relative to households without children. Our findings were consistent with those of other researchers who found that the advanced CTC was associated with a 25% decline in poverty and improved dietary quality for children. In a new preprint using HPS data, we find expiration of the advanced CTC was associated with a 12% increase in food insufficiency in households with children relative to households without children by February, and rates of food insufficiency continued to climb since February. While HPS data are not directly comparable to data collected prior to the pandemic, Reifman and Bovell-Ammon noted, rates of food insufficiency in March-April 2022 were about 3 to 4 times pre-pandemic levels. Food insufficiency among families with children poses a short and long-term moral and economic threat to the United States, they wrote. Even brief disruptions in access to food can have lasting consequences. The pair continued, not having enough to eat often disrupts children's cognitive and emotional development and education. This was the case for a child who disclosed that the reason she was fidgeting and not paying attention in class was that she did not have enough food to eat. There may be lifelong ramifications of not having enough to eat in childhood, including increased likelihood of poor health outcomes and avoidable medical expenditures across lifespan. Despite Manchin's baseless and dehumanizing claim that parents would use federal cash to buy drugs, Reifman and Bovell-Ammon pointed out that several analysts indicate families with low incomes overwhelmingly use advanced CTC payments on basic needs for children, including food, rent, utilities, clothing, and educational costs. There is also no evidence suggesting a reduction in employment among parents in families receiving CTC payments. It's not too late, Reifman and Bovell Ammen stressed, for Manchin and the GOP to change course. As Congress turns its attention to the next reconciliation package, there is an opportunity to reinstate the expanded CTC monthly payments. The pair wrote, adding, amidst continued inflation, rising food insufficiency in households with children, and the COVID-19 pandemic continuing to affect work, health, and the economy, continuation of the advanced CTC payments could help children avoid food insufficiency with immediate and lifelong personal and societal benefits. The most recent wave of HPS data, Reifman and Bovell Ammen noted, show that food insufficiency in the United States is concentrated in the lowest income households with children. Implementing an expanded CTC without exclusions due to work or immigration status will best reach children in families with the greatest need, to the benefit of all children and society, they added. While some policymakers have considered work requirements to receive CTC benefits, such requirements carry an administrative burden for states and families that often prevents those who most need benefits from receiving them and results in negative outcomes.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we looked into the adverse effects and potential dangers of psychotropic drugs. We went to France, the number one user of such medication, to see how psychotropic drugs prescribed much too readily and in a cocktail to cure feelings of anxiety and depression have in some cases led to madness, suicide, extreme acts of violence, and murder. Yet the root cause of the extensive use of such drugs seems to be much more than naive and ignorant doctors and desperate patients, especially when a multi-million dollar industry is at stake. Stay with us for the rest of the documentary.
In the Congress room, many conferences take place one after another, but nobody is dealing with the dangers of antidepressants. One of them is led by Anthony Rothschild, a psychiatrist well known for his successful books on psychotropic drugs. The great specialist is holding a debate on the adaptation of treatments depending on the illness. But not once does he say that antidepressants should not be prescribed. Our question is straightforward.
It seems that there is a lot of danger with antidepressants. What do you think about this? Like suicide or, murders?
No. I don't know what you're talking about, but I just told you there's no reliable scientific evidence that antidepressants cause people to commit murder or any other crime or suicide.
So how come that on boxes?
Right, this is not serious, okay?
Is this a surprising reaction? Anthony Rothschild also has conflicts of interest with an impressive number of pharmaceutical companies.
So I told you what I thought. You're going to keep asking me the same question.
Okay,
well, you got my quote, all right?
Okay, very good.
How can such things still be said in this day and age, when on all the stands promoting psychotropic medication, whole boards are covered by signs warning of side effects? Among the several side effects, the risk of suicide or violent behavior is prioritized by all. These warnings are a legal obligation enforced by medical organizations. But how much are these warnings worth next to the publicity hype from the pharmaceutical companies?
When you're depressed, where do you want to go? Nowhere. Who do you feel like seeing? No one. Depression hurts in so many ways.
These ads banned in France reach tens of millions of households in the United States, one of the rare countries where the promotion of medication is allowed. For the promoters of these ads, a new customer is a captive customer. This is what Michael Baum denounces, a lawyer specializing in the pharmaceutical industry. This man is a nightmare for the laboratories. His trials have cost them billions of dollars. His theme, denouncing the addictive effects of medication.
One of the issues with these drugs is once you're on, you can't get off.
they become a captive audience. And they get trained, basically, the patients get trained to stay on it. It's if they take the drug and then stop the drug, they start experiencing these brain zaps, or they start experiencing these nausea symptoms or these severe headaches or dizziness. And then they take the drug, they take it back, they go back on it, and it goes away. Well, they get reinforced with the concept of, I need to stay on it. And they think that maybe, and what doctors used to think, was that they were relapsing back into their depression. That isn't what was happening at all.
The dangers of psychotropic drugs have been well known for a long time. Since September 1991, the American Medication Agency has had to react against waves of complaints against Prozac, the grandfather of modern antidepressants. This drug has been blamed for hundreds of suicides and murders, and administration officials are getting together to determine whether a correlation exists between Prozac and acts of violence. In front of this committee of reputed psychiatrists are the families of victims.
My husband didn't believe me. He was a pharmacist. We came back, and on April 30, he just blew his brains out in front of all of us. How many more have to die before somebody looks? If we made a mistake, we're humans.
After being on Prozac for 21 days, my wife shot and killed both of these two boys right here. She turned the gun to herself and shot herself twice. I heard these people talking about scientific data. For those that don't say we have scientific data.
I entered therapy 1 year ago as a victim of rape. I stand before you today a victim of Prozac. It baffles my mind to think that a prescription drug I could simply compare to a felony of rape. But yes, they can be compared, because if a drug robs you of your will to live, then it has committed a felony equal to that of rape.
She shot herself on the head.
This was the date of my first.
For a whole day, witnesses will make statements. It's overwhelming.
I firmly believe the drug.
The internist.
How many more people are going to be killed and maimed before you do something? You have the power to change things. You have the power to listen to what we say and investigate what we say. We need help.
Following the statements, the committee votes.
There is credible evidence to support a conclusion that antidepressant drugs cause the emergence and or intensification of suicidality and or other violent behaviors. Those in favor of that statement vote yes. Those opposed to that statement, no.
There is total surprise. Unanimously, the committee declares that there is no link between Prozac and the violence described by the families of the victims.
Vote on the following statement.
Jeffrey Lieberman is a member of the committee. Later, he goes on to be the all-powerful president of the American Psychiatric Association. And of the 10 psychiatrists present during the vote, 9 of them had conflicts of interest with one or several pharmaceutical companies. When Prozac was launched, the Lilly Pharmaceutical Company worked very hard. But one of the board directors even denounced the methods he had himself used to boost sales of the drug. He is John Virapen, and he was director of Lilly in Sweden until 1988. And it's not his style to beat around the bush.
We are not patients, we're consumers. And we're being ripped off right, left, and center. And unfortunately, as I see it today, the drug companies have the power, total power. They are in all corners of the industrial complex. They're in there somewhere doing dirty work.
And you were a part of it.
And I was a part. That's why I'm able to tell you all of this. I was a part of it. I've done, my hands are dirty. I'm trying to clean now. It's redemption time.
It's time for redemption. And John Virapen has written a book with a provocative title, Side Effects, Death. Notably, it discusses the way in which he was asked to conceal side effects.
The doctors prescribe to the patient, but don't tell them anything because they don't know. They rely completely on what the pharma industry tells them. These little salesmen that run around, I was a salesman too, and they used to instruct me when I was a salesman. The first thing is, you don't talk side effects with doctors. Why do they do that? Because they want to make money, 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 money. They don't care about your lives. They only care about their wallets.
From conferences to interviews, John Virapin does not hesitate to reveal what he implemented to encourage sales, corruption, gifts, and trips.
To children. General practitioners, they don't usually get to go to big Congress and World Congress here and there. So one day I got the idea that maybe we should do something with these guys. So I gathered a whole bunch of them and took them to Singapore. Fly them down to Singapore and gave them works. I mean, it was exclusive. When they came back, my sales escalated.
In light of these accusations, Lilly, the lab that created Prozac, did not wish to meet with us. But this is what they said by email. John Virapin has not been employed by Lilly since 1988. He therefore cannot be considered as a credible source of information concerning the current activities of the group, its motives, or practices. The Lilly Pharmaceutical Company, like all the others, nevertheless fought hard so that the American administration did not impose a black box warning on antidepressant leaflets, an explicit caution against the risks of suicide or violent behavior. But in 2004, finally, it became a done deal. This victory is owed to the activism of victims' families and their lawyers, such as Andy Vickery. The pharmaceutical industry also has a bone to pick with this Texan. He also received billions in compensation during the famous arrangements whereby laboratories preferred to pay out rather than stand trial. To better explain how a pill can kill, he makes use of a puzzle. His demonstration, he claims, applies for all psychotropic drugs.
Is there a phenomenon, a distinct phenomenon, of Prozac-induced suicide?
The first attribute is the patients became suddenly suicidal. People who've never thought of killing themselves, of harming themselves, take one of these drugs, whoom, they go instantly from that feeling to death. The second piece of the puzzle was that the suicides were all violent. I've shared with you already the story of Pat Williamson. She was on Prozac 9 days when she came in one morning to her husband and said, "Honey, would you show me how to kill myself?" And her husband said, "Oh, Pat, please." And he decides to go check up on her after 15 or 20 minutes and finds that she has made 100 mutilating cuts in her body. The third piece of the puzzle that Eli Lilly noticed was an obsessive quality to the act. It's just this sudden impulse to do something really violent, really dangerous to themselves or others. And it's just, they're just overwhelmed by it. They're obsessed with the idea. And they cannot control their behavior. In the period of time between the person starts to take the drug and the time of their death or suicide attempt, that there's abnormal behavior. Something different is going on. And sometimes the medical help is, "Oh, you just need to take more of this drug. Let's increase your dose." It's like, "Oh, there's a little fire. Let's pour some gasoline on it." And the final piece of the puzzle is, almost all of the cases that I have handled, the death has happened within 30 days of the time the person either started the drug or had their dose increased.
Once again, Lilly Laboratory only answers our accusations by mail. They explain that one of the most striking studies in the last few years shows that there is a decrease in suicide, -32%, and in mortality, -49%, when depressed patients take antidepressants. But what is the truth? This study is contested by other studies that claim the contrary. And if in the United States, thousands of victims came to the forefront, then why would France be spared, the leading consumer worldwide of psychotropic drugs? In April 2014, a court trial would clarify the current state of affairs in an enlightening manner. Back in December 2008, Jean is depressed. He struggles to deal with his professional life
and at the birth of his son, he attempts suicide. He therefore went to the psychiatrist, Dr. Gosseres. The doctor recommends that he try out a new antidepressant, which was not yet available on the market, Brintellix. Jean did not react to the treatment. The psychiatrist proposed to double the dosage. A few days later, Jean set himself on fire. Corinne, Jean's wife, refused to believe that it was a random suicide. She alerted the authorities, and Dr. Gosseres was put under inspection on 7 charges. He was accused of embezzlement, but worse, putting others' lives in danger for at least 8 patients, including Jean, Corinne's husband. On April 30th, 2014, the doctor was strangely judged in Bordeaux, the court where he himself was a judiciary expert. He received a suspended sentence of 6 months that he appealed. But why would the pharmaceutical company Lundbeck, the creators of the antidepressants, not be investigated themselves? The pharmaceutical company Lundbeck has no interest in this affair going public. They've invested millions in order to get Brintellix approved by medical authorities. However, Jean was not at all the same since his dosage of Brintellix was raised, as described by Corinne and her mother. For Lundbeck, it is therefore not Brintellix that is to blame, but Jean's depression. It's a credible defense, which is used by all pharmaceutical companies when they are blamed. However, we also met with other victims of this trial period, and bizarrely, they all describe the same symptoms. Such as Christian Mounier, who also tested Brintellix for 8 months. Since, he has lost his job, his memory, and he describes himself as a vegetable. A man who is no longer himself, another who commits suicide, apparently devastating side effects for 8 sufferers. But there was also the suicide of 2 more patients just after coming off Brintellix. This bad streak should have alerted the authorities. However, nothing would come of it, as on the same day as Jean's self-immolation, Dr. Gosseres wiped his name from the file. His death was therefore no longer related to the clinical tests. The medical authorities explained to us that for each test of a drug, they only receive the results achieved across the whole territory. The botched trials of Dr. Gosseres were therefore lost in the mass and mixed with several other accepted studies across the world, as this document shows that makes Brintellix's market release official. Lundbeck throws the blame back to the public health authorities. So what can be said of the package insert that we found in the United States, where Brintellix has been approved since 2013? Side effects are documented in 2 whole pages. Especially, though, the principal paragraph warns against the raised risk of suicidal thoughts and behaviors. It's the famous black box warning. In other words, the highest alert level. In France, Brintellix has just been approved for sale on the market. It has therefore been judged as useful in fighting depression. The doors are slammed shut. Jean is responsible for his own atrocious suicide. Just like the death of Mark, Aurélie's murderous thoughts and suicide attempt, or the fall of Christian Mounier. If the effectiveness of such medication on most serious depressive states cannot be denied, how many more tragedies need to occur before the effects of psychotropic drugs on some patients are truly recognized?
Seems that as long as money and power are involved in the realm of healthcare, pills that are expected to cure depression actually cause suicide and murder. And that's it for this week's program. Until next week at another Aperture, it's goodbye. We'll be right back.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Gun supporters and expedient politicians who take firearms industry and other military-industrial complex big donor money while expressing heartfelt prayers are disingenuous, disgusting, and deserving of maximum shame, says F. Douglas Stephenson, researcher, in an article published under the heading Gunmaker profits soar as bloody massacres proliferate in the U.S. Stay tuned for more. U.S. citizens are waking up to the fact that so many politicians can be so easily bought by the weapons industry, an industry that doesn't care how many people must die to protect their huge profits. SafeHome.org reports that after a record year in 2020, gun sales in the U.S. dipped slightly in 2021. Still, with nearly 19 million guns sold, 2021 was the second highest year for gun sales in the U.S., behind only 2020, when estimated gun sales topped 21 million. The previous record year was 2016, with about 16 million guns sold. Total estimated gun sales fell 13% between 2020 and 2021, but they remained higher than they were in 2019, up nearly 40%. The large number of weapons in the United States of America is not only highly profitable for the weapons industry, but also further supports the myth that guns are necessary to maintain the image of rugged individualism. The total number of guns sold in 2021 is more than double the number sold in 2001. In fact, sales in the U.S. rose by about 155% between 2002 and 2021. No state had more gun sales in 2021 than Texas, where an estimated 1.6 million firearms were sold in the nation's second-largest state. Florida followed closely with 1.4 million firearms sold. DearLord.com reported that weapons makers Roger and Winchester both had profit spikes in recent earnings filings. Their latest 2021 quarters topped record sales the companies had experienced even during the height of 2020 gun sales surge. The numbers come after July 2021 came in as the second best July on record for FBI background checks on gun sales. Roger reported its net sales in the first 6 months of 2021 were up over $130 million or 51% over the same time last year. The company did nearly $200 million in firearm sales alone between April and June. That represents a 54% increase over the same period in 2020, even though the onset of the coronavirus pandemic and rioting drove Americans to gun stores at record rates during that time period. Similarly, Winchester reported the first 6 months of 2021 produced a $412 million or 108% increase in sales. The gun and ammo makers' sales increased even further by 110% when looking at the April to June period. Winchester's parent company, Olin Corporation, saw net income climb from a $120 million loss in the April to June period of 2020.